The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement on Federal News Network. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy, trends, innovations, and debates. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is Bob Metzger. Bob is a shareholder in Rogers Joseph O'Donnell, where he chairs the Cybersecurity and Privacy Practice Group. Bob is a leading expert in cybersecurity and federal contracting and has served as counsel of record in many major IT and cybersecurity litigations. He was a co-author of the 2018 report, Deliver Uncompromised for MITRE, which has contributed importantly to DoD's CMMC initiative, which we're going to be talking about at some point during the show, and other supply chain and cybersecurity activity in the federal government. Bob, it's great to see you on. Thanks so much for joining me on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to discussion because, you know, as we were talking before we started the show, there are so many things going on and so many rules, regulations, guidance coming emanating from the federal government that we can't possibly discuss it all, you know, in a day, let alone, for an hour show. So we're going to hit some of the highlights and talk about and try to, you know, set the stage first by talking about the threat environment that is shaping government policy and commercial responses as well to what's going on in the cyber world. So, your thoughts on the cybersecurity and threat environment?
It's a very difficult environment, and it has become aggravated at both the strategic level as well as the tactical level, if you will. And I was listening this morning to FBI Director Ray, who spoke to a group of the American Bar Association about a week ago or so. And again, he spoke to the dangers that are poised by China, especially in its ability to hack into U.S. information systems, not just to steal valuable data, but also to plant malware that could be used to deny the operation or damage the operation of different aspects of our critical infrastructure. We face a world in which the geopolitical situation has worsened over the last several years to include several areas of active armed conflict. Our adversaries use what are called blended operations to employ non-kinetic means, that is, things that are not weapons, such as cyber attacks, to couple those with kinetic means to achieve their ends. Our adversaries are not deterred by the same methods that might have worked decades ago to prevent hostile action. Adversaries are aggressive, they are patient, they are skillful, they are pernicious, and all too often, Roger, they are successful. And while China is at the top of the list of cyber and supply chain adversaries, obviously we have to pay serious attention to Russia, which is very skillful and does not operate within norms that apply to most nations. And we should not neglect Iran, especially now after the October 7th events, or North Korea. This presents a daunting problem. You know, back in 2018, I was the co-author of the MITRE report you mentioned. And, we looked at the threat environment with some, classified input back at the time. And we were worried about a range of outcomes. And unfortunately, all of them have come more or less true and then some. Back then, we were not really worried about the criminal component that now is so virulent in the form of ransomware attackers. Mm-hmm. And at that time, we were focusing on how bad actors might steal information that would damage the effectiveness of our national defense capabilities. Now we have to worry about bad actors who are deliberately positioning themselves to damage not just critical infrastructure upon which the U.S. population depends, but many aspects of important commercial infrastructure upon which our daily lives depend. The Change Healthcare ransomware attack is a good example of where ransomware actors may have had no more intent than just to make a lot of money. and may not have attacked what we ordinarily consider to be a critical infrastructure function, that is payment systems for prescriptions and healthcare providers, but where they've had a devastating effect upon those providers and patients who are affected. And as a final kind of preview threat, you know, much of the focus of our protective measures in the past 4 or 5 years, you know, has been to stop the exfiltration or outflow of sensitive but unclassified information to unauthorized persons, especially China. But we now realize that there are other threat vectors and purposes, including threat vectors not just through IT, but through operational technology, threat vectors through many elements of the supply chain, and successful subordination or subversion of individuals, the human factor. And we've seen that the damages from successful attacks through the cyber and supply chain are in many ways broader, worse, and more difficult to correct than we might have expected. All of this, of course, is reflected in Executive Order 14028 from what, March of 2 years ago, last year. And that remains an important document that helps to understand this flurry of activities that we see from so many different federal agencies attempting to, you know, respond across the whole of government. The big question, Roger, is just how well those things are coordinated. And maybe the bigger question is, you know, are they in fact workable from the standpoint of the many tens of thousands of companies affected, not just government contractors, but others who are in the supply chain for critical infrastructure or who own or operate critical infrastructure facilities.
Yeah, you touched on something that we can start, you know, with regard to the executive order and the government's response. You know, what is your assessment of how well coordinated the federal government is with all these various, you know, policy, whether it's FAR cases, whether it's, you know, the cyber incident reporting for critical infrastructure and the Act and the implementation of that, and CMMC and software attestation. So the first question I want to ask is just, what's your assessment of how well the government is sort of working together in a framework?
Well, Roger, you know, I've been at this for a decade or so. And, you know, for years, I went to events like the RSA Security Conference that's coming up and to events at MITRE, you know, where so-called security specialists, you know, were speculating about things and wishing more people paid more attention to them. Well, now the coin has flipped. We've got an awful lot of people paying much attention to many things. And I have to give the administration credit for putting out a lot of ambitious policies in the areas that we've described, as well as on artificial intelligence. And that's fantastic. But the short answer, the glib answer that came to mind in response to your question is the impossibility of everything. And, you know, in truth, I'm a little bit dismayed. I try to make sense of and reconcile the various regulatory initiatives of OMB, GSA, CISA, DOD, FTC, FCC, SEC. Everybody has common purposes, and they're all well-intentioned. But the presence of common purposes does not necessarily align common actions. And it does not necessarily produce obligations that are workable or affordable to the hundreds of thousands of companies who are or may be affected. And I am concerned broadly that this siege of obligations will produce substantial burdens on technical, financial, and human resources of the private sector, you know, without commensurate benefits. And, you know, in the end, the outcomes do matter. You know, having a process that's highly exaggerated, if not exacerbated, you know, that doesn't produce useful outcomes to the private sector is not good security for me. To me, that's, you know, and it's an elevation of, you know, process over substantive accomplishment.
Yeah, and when you were describing it initially, about impossibility or just I was thinking of the don't boil the ocean, right? Don't try to boil the ocean, which is so many different things going on to solve every problem. It seems like to the extent folks get at cross purposes and some of these things, to the point that the investments in the private sector have to make effect have to be effective and make good business sense to get to the security place we want to be. Is that a fair observation?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the, I mean, fundamentally, it all has to come down to the money, the business case.
Yeah.
You know, you can, the government has obviously legislative power, and it has enforcement sanctions, and it can increase those. And it can threaten civil False Claims Act actions. It can mount investigations. It can seek contractual remedies. It can add new regulations and impose new duties and assert new authorities to go into companies and to demand that they do things. But each one of these companies is a business, as you know very well, Roger. And in the end, businesses have to be able to afford to satisfy federal demands if they are to do them successfully. And if the net of federal demands is unaffordable and the benefit is conjectural, then at the very least, I think we're at risk of seeing a sizable number of companies elect not to sell to the federal government and remove themselves from the position they will be subject to all these obligations. Some of the obligations aren't limited to government contractors, but many of those are. And that's, you know, a hazardous outcome. Also, you know, you talk about boiling the ocean. There's, you know, no coherence within the government as to what companies should do to protect themselves, as distinct from this great enthusiasm for reporting. So many different entities are now specifying different obligations to report using different criteria. It creates, a thicket in the fog of what you are supposed to do. I have long supported event reporting, but, you know, it's only one side of the equation. If you have that event reporting, you really need corresponding means to act upon the reports in a timely fashion and to give value back to the commercial enterprises that do report. And I see, you know, a huge spike on the left side of the graph and how many people have to report which and when to whom, but not so much progress on the right side of the graph as to what happens with it. Just to complete the thought, you know, what we're kind of missing is, you know, what are we trying to do here? Are we trying to just massively upscale the reporting obligation without, or are we, should we be thinking also about what ways can the federal government help to inform and instruct critical infrastructure sectors and different forms of government contractors on how actually to protect themselves? I mean, all things being equal, you know, I'd rather have a company with a secure outcome have less occasion to report. And yet, you know, increasingly the weight of the demands, you know, tend to be falling towards reporting, and maybe we'll divert corporate resources from potentially available resources, if affordable, to be more robust, more resistant to attack, and more resilient after attack. We have to find a balance there, or we've done a great job in, you know, sending signals of when we've been hurt rather than acting to prevent them and to mitigate their impact quickly.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, when you're describing that, I'm thinking government, like when I put my government contract hat on, I'm thinking, you know, outcome-based, you know, approaches to getting things done versus process reporting-based approaches to addressing, you know, things. And you see it all the time, that tension in the acquisition system. Bob, we're at the first break. When we come back, we'll try to lift the fog a little bit on some of these cyber rules and run down through some of them. My guest today is Bob Metzger. Bob is a shareholder at Rogers Joseph O'Donnell, where he chairs their cybersecurity and privacy practice group. I'm Roger Waldron, and you're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Network. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Network. I'm Roger Waldron. My guest today is Bob Metzger. Bob is a shareholder at Rogers Joseph O'Donnell, where he chairs the Cybersecurity and Privacy Practice Group. Bob is a leading expert on cybersecurity and federal contracting, and he's served as counsel of record on a number of major IT and cybersecurity litigations. He also is a co-author of the 2018 report, Deliver Uncompromised for MITRE, which contributed importantly to DOD's CMMC initiative, as well as other supply chain and cybersecurity initiatives in the federal government. And Bob, that was great setting the stage, you know, the environment, the overarching sort of response by the federal government and the focus on it. And we talked a lot about all the process and incident reporting, that sort of thing. Well, let's dive into some of the particulars and look at some of the legislation and or regulations. And the first one I want to ask you about is the CISA rulemaking relative to the Cyber Incident Reporting for Critical Infrastructure Act. I'm going to just mention them and let you go. And
let's go. You know, it's been said many times, and I forget whether this is from Shakespeare or elsewhere, that brevity is the soul of wit. Well, that apparently does not apply within CISA, because it produced the proposed rule for CERCEA at a modest 440 pages when printed double-spaced text. Now, maybe I'm not giving due appreciation for the fantastic effort that obviously went into it. I know that's there. But if you produce a rule that is so long that only unbusy people who are dedicated to this particular task actually have the time to read the rule, one might question whether you're going to get whether you're going to get the comments you should receive. And you might even wonder whether the length itself is intended to deflect, defer, or avoid comments because you don't want them. I hope that's not the case. So, you know, this is a fascinating thing. I mean, Congress had a very broad statute serving what obviously is a very important purpose. We do want to know more about events that affect critical infrastructure. But, you know, a proposed rule that's 440 pages leaves a lot to be dissected. And yet we also have to appreciate that this is on that regulatory process where slow is, you know, too nice a description of its responsiveness to the actual evolution of threats and their impacts. The rule is not expected to be final until late 2025 and not to go into effect until late 2026. So there's a fraction of Bob, me, that says, well, I'm not going to read the 440 pages because we're so far removed from when this thing is actually going to have an impact. Happily, the Congressional Research Service produced a shorter artifact, but even it is pretty incredible. It requires a critical infrastructure entity to report to CISA within 72 hours when it's the victim of a substantial cyber incident, and it requires reporting of 24 hours if a payment on ransomware is made. Now, it exempts small businesses according to SBA standards. And so I think that CISA claims that of the 6.3 million businesses in the United States, only 300,000 of them will be subject to these reporting requirements. Well, that's still quite a lot.
Yeah.
And the reporting requirements themselves are very demanding in terms of what you actually have to report. There's a list of, say, 15 things, the technical details of the incident, a timeline, which vulnerabilities were exploited, a description of the security defenses, the known techniques, tactics, and procedures, known indicators of compromise, samples of malware. Well, of course I'd want all that. I'm leaving aside the question of what CISA is going to do with all that. But if you put yourself in the position of the ordinary business and you suffer a serious attack such that you have to make this report within the 72 hours, just how likely is it that you're actually going to have any of that information on hand, any form ready to communicate? Well, for all but a few companies, the answer is no. And so what this will do, Roger, is to promote companies essentially hiring cyber security and forensics firms on a steady state basis to essentially be full-time partners, whether those are security incident and event management providers or security operations center providers. Because unless you've already got the resources under contract delivered to you by cloud or on premises or part of your own organization, the chance of being able to, you know, actually make these timely reports with the information that's required is pretty slight or none. So that's a big expense that I don't think has been, you know, really recognized. It says that a third-party entity, such as an insurance company, can make a report for you. Well, I have actual experience dealing with insurance companies and reports to insurance companies, and I can tell you to a certainty that while their demands as to what happened and how have increased and are quite burdensome and themselves quite difficult to accomplish within the time allowed, they don't come close to what CIRCEA's proposed rule expects. And then there's something that really has been less understood than need be, Roger. It is that this isn't just a rule about IT systems. This goes to substantial cyber incidents that result in a substantial loss of confidentiality of IT systems, okay? But also it goes to events that seriously impact the safety or resiliency of an entity's operational technology, OT, or that disrupt the ability of the entity to conduct its business. Now, if I were, you know, sitting at CISA and wanting to be sure that water infrastructure operators told me if there was an attack that might compromise the ability of a water system to work, of course I'd want to know that. But, you know, when I look at these reporting thresholds and put my lawyer hat on, the first thing I'm going to do is to be asking myself, just when or how can I decide that something isn't substantial? Because as soon as I admit that the event is substantial, then all of a sudden I've got this, you know, the barrage of obligations to do that probably are impossible to assemble unless I've already got somebody under contract to have them ready at a moment's notice. And yet, you know, the enforcement is going to be pretty strict. I mean, the first thing is that CIRCEA gives CISA an opportunity to make some administrative demands or requests for information. And that essentially punts the 72-hour timetable to begin with. And then if you don't respond to the request for information, then you can be subpoenaed by the Department of Justice. You also, I think, lose what safe harbor you might get. Finally, you know, this rule says, well, if there's interagency agreements, you know, you don't have to report the same event to CISA. You can report to the agency that's in charge and, you know, that they will report to CISA. I got a couple of problems with that. First, I'm not sure today that CISA has the means, mechanisms, people, tools, or money to deal with reports in these volumes. And I don't think the budgetary estimate that it suggested is nearly enough. And I'm not sure Congress is going to pay for it. And I definitely don't want industry to be burdened with all of these obligations if these reports are just going to add to the volume of info in the data lake that isn't being used. Second, the only way they can deal with it probably is through the use of AI, which presents its own security and efficacy questions that I doubt they have fully considered. And third is the more philosophical issue, and I'm a little divided on this one. The philosophical issue is, okay, if there are 16 sector-specific agencies under PPD 21, and if we're expecting a 17th to appear as space systems, as I would recommend, do we really want to make CIRCEA the focal point for all of this? Because it will be the sector-specific agencies, and CISA is for some sectors. You know, do we really want to displace them? You know, do we really want to say that the report has to go first to the CISA rather than the FCC or the FTC or to FERC or energy systems? You know, I'm not sure that philosophically that's the right answer, especially if you consider this problem of addressability. What's more likely to generate useful results? Is it a massive obligation to report rapidly to CISA on everything, regardless of whether you know it or not, where you're not sure how CISA is going to deal with it internally, and you're also not sure how CISA is going to communicate it to the sector-specific agency? Or would it be better to have CISA be informed by the sector-specific agencies and to give them more power? So there's some many small questions, many big questions as well.
So that's a great point, because when you were describing that, I thought of, you used the term addressability. It's like it seems to me you want to give the information to the subject matter experts in the government for your particular sector so that they can understand what, you know, what the implications are for what happened, I think, as opposed to like filtering it through another government agency to that organization. That's a great point. And we have about a minute and a half left in this segment, so I wanted to get your quick take on the FAR. I mean, we're talking about reporting.
Well, the FAR cyber rule, when I read that, I thought this is another example of, you know, great intentions seemingly detached from implementation realities. I thought this thing was basically, I thought somebody was tasked by EO 14028 to look at things that were really important in the president's executive order and make sure There was a regulation that imposed them upon federal contractors. And the word, the simple three-letter word that came to mind when I first read it was, wow. And, you know, for good reasons. It says, okay, it's going to apply to most government contractors, including commercial products and services, COTS items, and contracts below the simplified acquisition threshold. That's a big group. Yep. And then it says you have to report security incidents to CISA within 8 hours and updates every 72 hours until remediated. And it says you have to maintain a software bill of material for software used in contract performance. And it says you have to provide access to contractor information systems and personnel to support incident response. I mean, I could put the hold on there, sign up for all of those. You know, I mean, yes, the purposes are great, but telling government contractors that CISA or GSA or it's kind of, you know, has the right to basically come on site, take look, talk to anyone, you know, without assurance of protection of your proprietary information, without respect for the confidentiality of your employment relationships or the privacy of individuals, this is a big thing. It also, you know, has an expansion of the definition of information and communications technology to include more stuff, which includes electronic media, IoT devices, and operational technology. This is a lot, you know, and if you study any one of these bullets, you know, you realize that they're actually way more complicated than are suggested by these assemblies in this proposed rule. I've been, you know, including some work for MITRE, I've been looking at software assurance for 8 years or 7 years. And I have a lot of admiration for the work Alan Friedman and others have done on software bill of materials. But the, you know, cheerful demand that all government contractors have SBOMs simply does not understand the difficulty of doing that.
Yes.
The cost and complexity, the uncertain value. It doesn't differentiate between when it really matters and when it's just another make work assignment to check many boxes at high expense. So I hope that, you know, there are about 80 comments to this rule, and I haven't had a chance to look at them, but I hope that it's considered carefully because, you know, for government contractors, it looks to me to be extremely well-intended, but unusual in its scope and arguably outside the underlying statutory authority.
Yeah, and I particularly appreciate your technical legal term. Wow, I like that because that's when I read it, I had the same reaction. And it seems to me the definition of ICT, I don't know how you exclude a contract. I mean, the scope of what it's going to apply to is, to your point, is just who knows and how do you figure out whether you're outside the box or not. But anyway, Bob, we're up on the break. When you come back, I think we'll turn to CMMC, and I know you supported the coalition and worked on the coalition's comments in response to CMC. So I want to take some time and talk about that, those comments in particular, and just CMMC in general. My guest today is Bob Metzger. Bob is a shareholder in Rogers Joseph O'Donnell, where he chairs the Cybersecurity and Privacy Practice Group. I'm Roger Wilder, and you're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Network. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Network. My guest today is Bob Metzger. Bob is a shareholder at Rogers Joseph O'Donnell, where he chairs the Cybersecurity and Privacy Practice Group. He is a leading expert on cybersecurity and federal contracting and served on as counsel record on many major IT and cybersecurity litigations. And Bob, you know, one of your things is we were very appreciative of your support and the drafting of our comments in response to the proposed CMMC rule. And so I'm just going to, you know, the great comments, lots of incisive analysis and feedback to DOD. What's your take?
So there are a lot of important things going on here. The most important one that everyone should recognize is that whatever you might question, you know, has DOD enforced these cyber obligations that have been imposed upon companies for a decade or so? No, not so much that we really know. But CMMC is that enforcement mechanism. CMMC suddenly says, look, we're not going to wait until we have a problem with an incident you report. Your eligibility to perform future contracts for DOD that involve controlled unclassified information will depend upon whether you do or don't pass a CMMC certification assessment. And they intend to roll this out in four phases over 3 years. And they've made a commitment to it. And the fact that this proposed rule came out at all is meaningful because it had to go through interagency review, and not all agencies were enthusiastic at the outset. It had to go through OMB review, and it got input from the national security community. So the fact that this proposed rule is out means that DoD is serious. It's also mentioned in the new DoD cyber industrial strategy document. So it's coming. It's real. Got to take it seriously. But then the question is, okay, this rule could cover as many as 220,000 companies. About 130,000 of those, Roger, are just companies that have federal contract information subject to the FAR basic safeguarding clause. These companies don't have CUI, but they're subject to, 15 or 17, depending on how you count, of the CMMC assessment methods. My first point is, look, CMMC is going to be expensive for everybody, even if you've already taken responsible measures to comply with the underlying NIST standard. Let's kind of focus that expense upon the people that have information of some impact or significance. Not all information is created equally. So, I would recommend, and I think we did put into the coalition comments, that we take a pass for now on applying the CMMC rigors to the 130,000 companies that are at level one. Now, there's about 70 to 75,000 companies who are at level two, 95% of whom at present are to be subject to a third-party CMMC certification assessment. But there's kind of an assumption there that the impact of DoD's security to the integrity of warfighter systems kind of is all the same for all those 75,000 who will be subject to these rigors. Well, is that really true? I mean, might it be possible to look with more care as to the nature of work assigned to one contractor or one contract, one supply chain as opposed to another? I'm worried about a couple of things critically. On the supply side, I'm worried about the availability of sufficient trained assessors to do this. On the supplier side, I'm worried about the costs in terms of money, trained personnel, and technical resources that will be available or affordable to these thousands of companies who will find that they have to get through a certification assessment. I want to be sure that we protect the information and the programs and the contracts that are most important. And if that means we take a more flexible approach to other companies, if that means that we allow self-attestation for some larger subgroup that's at level two, I'm for it. And that's notable, Roger, because I was the author of part of the MITRE report that said that self-attestation doesn't really work, and I don't believe it does. But that said, imposing a third-party assessment cost upon 70,000 companies may not be achievable by some significant fraction of them, especially those that are small businesses. And well-intended rules with laudable goals that cannot be actualized or accomplished by those who are regulated are not successful rules.
Yeah, that big, it seems to me, issue is the impact, particularly on small businesses. And so many reports, whether it's Bloomberg, GAO, has done reports on the shrinking defense industrial base. And this just could, with a lack of flexibility, this could actually, further that shrinkage as well. And one thing I wanted to ask you about is the external service providers. I know that's an area that, we're concerned about in terms of, for those businesses who use external service providers as for their operations or IT operations, what happens in that case? And then I want to shift real quickly to the Cybersecurity Fraud Initiative.
As a matter of fact, I believe that a very high fraction of the defense industrial base at level two and a significant fraction at level three already use external service providers. Right. They already use managed service providers. smaller number use managed security as a service providers. They do so because they just don't have the people or the expertise or the technical assets internally to do it. So they're looking to people that make it their business to help, you know, with the organization of their network, its management, its updating, and the protection of information on that network. There's a huge community of managed service providers, a very large percentage of which are small businesses. The problem with the, there are two problems. You know, one, within the rule, there's insufficient clarity as to how managed service providers or other external service providers should establish the sufficiency of their security. They should not get a free pass. But it's not a perfect fit to apply the NIST 171 standards to MSPs who are not actually handling CUI and don't have government contracts. And the rule hasn't really sorted that out. Also, the rule has said some good things. We encourage ESPs, and some bad things. Certain types of ESPs are subject to CMMC assessment, even though today there's no contractual or legal method to accomplish that. But we also have to connect what's in the rule to some other actions of DOD, and that is a document put out by the DOD CIO's office at the end of December, which seems to require that cloud service offerings used by companies subject to CMMC must meet all 325 security requirements of FedRAMP moderate, and can have no plans of action and milestone open, no gaps. And they have to have documentation that is complete by the FedRAMP moderate standards in order to be found equivalent. That essentially doubles down on what's already very hard for companies that are seeking to get approved FedRAMP services, even harder than that they are actually required to do. And it would essentially cut to a tiny number the cloud service, the cloud service providers who would satisfy this. So in my view, it's essential for small, medium, and large businesses who sell to DOD to have access to a range of external service providers, including the CSPs and other MSPs who rely upon cloud infrastructure, to have this in a way that is affordable, readily accessible, and without the hazards of either unknown process and therefore unknown certification outcomes, or unknowable but potentially unaffordable expense.
Yeah, that it just seems like a huge hurdle, you know, in the marketplace.
I think it's one they're aware of. Maybe this is, you know, hope over realism, but I think we'll see some improvements in the final rule and maybe some adjustments to that DOD instruction.
Right. But Bob, we're up on the break. So when we come back, we'll talk about the civil cyber fraud initiative a little bit to wrap up the show. My guest today is Bob Metzger. Bob is a shareholder at Rogers Joseph O'Donnell, where he chairs the Cybersecurity and Privacy Practice Group. I'm Roger Waldron. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Network. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Network. My guest today is Bob Metzger. Bob is a shareholder at Rogers Joseph O'Donnell, where he chairs their Cybersecurity and Privacy Practice Group. And, you know, Bob, there's always, you know, implications for government contractors when it comes to Civil False Claims Act and that sort of thing. And cybersecurity is no different. So I know one thing that I think DOJ has launched, right, is the Civil Cyber Fraud Initiative. So what is that, and what do people need to know?
In October of 2021, DOJ announced the Civil Cyber Fraud Initiative. It said that it was going to use the tools of the False Claims Act to kind of go after people who misrepresented their cybersecurity or failed to make disclosures as required or otherwise violated obligations under contract for cybersecurity. Now, I've got a couple of relevant and bona fides. One is that way back when I was an equity partner at Kirkland & Ellis, where most of my practice was defending public companies against False Claims Act cases, often brought by the Department of Justice and often in the aerospace industry, although the issues then were more product quality. Jumping ahead to the present, I'm an expert witness in one instance for Kirkland & Ellis on a company that is the subject of a Civil Cyber Fraud Act pursuit by DOJ, and then Another is involving non-conforming electronics. Another a supply chain violation. So I have experience both being a first chair and defending False Claims Act actions and present experience in how current laws and regulations are being applied. I can tell everybody what they already know is that you should do everything prudent to avoid finding yourself in the crosshairs of the Department of Justice on an FCA case, because they're extraordinarily expensive and disruptive and the financial consequences can be grievous. But I can also tell you that in the real world, it's difficult for whistleblowers to prevail. The business case for whistleblower counsels to take relator actions and to pursue them successfully is not so clear. And often these cases are subject to an array of evidentiary questions and an assembly of bona fide legal defenses. One of the most prominent cases in the area was the Marcus versus Aerojet case, which was brought in October 2015. I mean, that was a pretty serious set of allegations by a guy who'd been making charge of their, you know, cybersecurity. Case was brought on October 29th, 2015. It was settled 6.5 years later on April 27th, 2022 for $9.1 million, including the amount, I think, that went to the whistleblower. Huge expense to defend it, highly painful public discussion of bad conduct. But, you know, by the standards of some public companies, paying $9 million in settlement after a 5.5 year case is not an outcome they can't handle. For all of the talk of the Civil Cyber Fraud Initiative, so far, there's really been only three public decisions, Roger, that have any bearing upon it. And two of them really are sort of, in two of them, cyber is incidental rather than central to the outcome. I'm referring to Comprehensive Health Services, a $930,000 settlement in February of 22, and Jelly Bean Communications, a $293,771 settlement in March of 2023. Cyber was not the central allegation of discrepant billing, but it was present. The biggest settlement that DOJ has claimed some credit for was the Verizon Business Network Services case, in which a settlement was announced on September 5 of last year. Verizon paid $4 million for disclosed and remediated cybersecurity contracts relating to trusted internet connections for GSA. There was no False Claims Act case filed by a whistleblower. That was a voluntary disclosure. DOJ had a role in settling it. Now, I've heard DOJ say, and I know from my personal activities, that they are, in fact, you know, active in pursuing cases. But, you know, it's easier to make sensational allegations than it is to prove them. And in many of these cases, the actual injury or damages can be difficult even to estimate, much less to prove. And so, yes, we should take it seriously. Yes, I do take it seriously. I always advocate to companies that they listen carefully to internal grievances, that they consider carefully the best way to avoid any question as to their intentions or to their actions, and that they document responsible measures. But I am not among those who think that the Department of Justice is, you know, around every street corner waiting to pounce upon any debatable activity, because the record so far just doesn't support that. And my knowledge of how hard these cases are to bring and win certainly doesn't support that. It's a business decision for DOJ, for the whistleblower counsel, for the companies, and for the whistleblowers themselves. Take it seriously? Sure. You know, be fearful of it? No, just be careful.
Right. I would think in this area in particular too, it's so complex and there's so many gray areas that it's, you know, if it's a TAA, you know, compliance issue, that's a lot, I think, easier to, in most cases, let's say. I don't want to.
If I can have, you know, 1 second on the point, sure. It's one thing if you've, you know, been mischarging Medicare for medical devices or pharmaceutical goods where you know that you're making the federal government pay more than it costs you. But it's quite another thing to be looking at, you know, one or another requirement within a NIST standard where even experts could debate the, you know, the best or the acceptable outcomes. And, you know, there's rarely unanimity of views in the application of cyber standards at a high level, and there can be much room for reasonable disagreement and discussion at the operational level as to what is the right conduct. Extreme conduct and conduct in bad faith can, you know, push the needle back towards a higher risk of liability. But a lot of these cases are, you know, in a lot of these cases, you're dealing with a set of regulations and security requirements that have never been praised for their absolute clarity and the immediate availability of certain responses.
Well, on that note, we got to end the show, Bob. I want to thank my guest today, Bob Metzger. Bob is a shareholder at Rogers Joseph O'Donnell, where he chairs their cybersecurity and privacy practice group. I'm Roger Waldron, and you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Network.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement on Federal News Network. Tune in Tuesday mornings at 11 or subscribe to this show on iTunes or Podcast One.